Okay, so you're trying to really get a handle on some pretty complex legal topics and you want to do it quickly.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the theme of being a law student, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Trying to drink from a fire hose.
Yeah, and that's what we try to help you do here on the Deep Dive. And today we're tackling a really fascinating Arizona Supreme Court case, State v. Cornell. It's a deep dive into a case that really showcases self-representation in court, prosecutorial conduct, and the really, really detailed process of how death penalty cases are reviewed.
Yeah, this is a big one. State v. Cornell really pulls back the curtain on some really core parts of our legal system. And I think, as we get into this, we'll see how it touches on what happens when someone decides to be their own lawyer and the ethics that prosecutors have to follow and how seriously the courts look at appeals, especially when it's a death penalty case. And I think for everyone listening, whether you're focused on trial procedure or legal ethics or appeals, this case is going to give you a good grasp of the big legal ideas at play and why they matter so much.
We've got some great resources to help us break this all down, too. We're looking at some material specifically designed for law students, like they're giving us a podcast-style rundown of the key points.
Right.
We also have a detailed case brief that sort of lays out the facts and the journey that the case took through the courts. And then we have a standard legal brief, which really dives into the legal arguments and the reasoning behind the court's decision. So
Okay.
let's get into it.
Yeah, let's unpack this.
All right, let's start at the very beginning with the crime itself and what happened during the initial trial.
All right, so we're going back to November 1990, but the events that lead to the trial actually happened the year before in 1989. And what happened was Joe Cornell ended up being convicted of first-degree murder for killing his former partner, Daphne, and he was also convicted of attempted murder for wounding Daphne's father, Victor. And this whole terrible situation stemmed from a shooting that happened after, from what we can tell, a very troubled relationship.
Yeah, very complicated, very charged situation. And during the trial, Cornell's defense focused on this claim of temporary insanity.
Right.
But here's where it gets interesting. He actually chose to represent himself at trial.
Wow.
Now, that's a pretty bold move in any legal situation, but especially in a murder trial, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he did have a public defender who was appointed as advisory counsel, so he wasn't totally alone, but still, he was the one making the ultimate decisions about his defense.
That's a huge decision to make.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder how much he really understood about the legal system and what the risks were of representing himself.
Absolutely. And so the jury, ultimately, they weren't convinced by that temporary insanity defense.
No.
They found him guilty of first-degree murder, and as a result, he was given a death sentence for Daphne's murder.
Right. And it's important to remember with a death sentence, the court has to find at least one aggravating circumstance, something beyond just the crime itself that makes the defendant seem even more guilty.
Yeah, absolutely. So that sets the stage for the initial outcome, a death sentence. But as we know, this isn't where the story ends, right?
No, not at all.
This case then goes up on appeal to the Arizona Supreme Court. And that's where things start to get really, really complex. So what were the big legal questions that the appellate court had to deal with?
Well, the Arizona Supreme Court zeroed in on two main issues. The first one was about whether it was okay to read the indictment, the formal list of charges to the jury during the trial. And the second one, and this one sparked a lot more debate, was about a comment that the prosecutor made during the trial about what might happen if Cornell was found not guilty by reason of insanity.
Okay, so let's break those down one by one. Starting with the indictment being read to the jury, on the surface, that seems like a pretty standard part of a trial, doesn't it?
Right, it does. You would think so.
Why did that become such a big deal that the higher court had to get involved?
It's interesting because it does seem routine, but the Arizona Supreme Court agreed that it's standard procedure, and their analysis was pretty straightforward. They pointed to the Arizona Rules of Criminal Procedure, which actually require that the clerk of the court read the indictment to the jury. So basically, the trial court was just doing what it was supposed to do.
Got it.
And the whole point of that indictment, is to tell the defendant exactly what they're being charged with, and it sort of sets the boundaries for the whole trial.
So that issue was pretty open and shut then.
Yeah, pretty much. The Arizona Supreme Court did look at whether reading the indictment might have prejudiced the jury against Cornell, but they decided it didn't. And they were very clear that the jury was told that the indictment itself wasn't evidence. It's not proof of guilt. It was just the official statement of the charges against him.
Okay, so the indictment issue was resolved without too much trouble, but the prosecutor's remark, that sounds like it had the potential to cause some real problems.
Yeah, it did.
So what exactly did the prosecutor say, and why did it raise red flags on appeal?
the comment that really caught the court's attention was when the prosecutor suggested that if Cornell was found not guilty by reason of insanity, he might go free. And the big concern here, and why the court saw this as a problem, is that it could have totally misled the jury about what really happens if someone gets that verdict. Mm-hmm. You know, it could make them think that if you're found not guilty by reason of insanity, you just walk out of the courtroom with no strings attached, which isn't necessarily true at all.
Right. That's a really important distinction because jurors might be hesitant to find someone insane, even if the evidence points that way, if they think that person is just going to be released back into the community.
Exactly.
So the court did ultimately acknowledge that what the prosecutor said was misconduct, right?
Yes, they did. They were very clear that the prosecutor's comment was wrong. Prosecutors have a responsibility to make sure the trial is fair. And that kind of statement throws in speculation and potentially false information that could mess with how the jury thinks about a very specific legal standard.
Okay, but, and I feel like there's a but coming, it wasn't enough to overturn the conviction, right? The court called it a harmless error. But that idea, while it sounds pretty simple, can be really controversial, especially in death penalty cases where any mistake carries so much weight. So how can something be considered harmless when a person's life is on the line?
That's the big question. And the court's reasoning was based on a couple of things. First, they looked at how strong Cornell's insanity defense actually was. And even the trial judge had said it wasn't very credible. And then the appeals court looked at all the evidence the prosecution had presented to show that the murder was premeditated. And they found that evidence to be really strong and convincing.
So they were basically saying that even without that improper comment from the prosecutor, the jury would have probably reached the same verdict, rejecting the insanity defense and finding him guilty based on the other evidence.
Yeah, that's it. They were saying that even though the prosecutor's remark was wrong, it didn't make the trial so unfair that it would have changed the outcome. They basically said that even though prosecutors are held to a high ethical standard, not every mistake they make means a conviction has to be overturned. There has to be a real chance that the mistake actually affected the jury's decision.
Okay, that's a huge distinction that I think anyone studying law needs to understand. And then there's another big part of this case, Cornell's choice to represent himself. We talked about it a bit before, but what legal standards did the court have to look at to make sure he was giving up his right to a lawyer in a valid way?
The legal standard for when someone waives their right to counsel, it's pretty strict. The court needs to be absolutely sure that it's knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. That means the defendant has to understand the charges against them, the possible punishments, the risks of representing themselves, and they have to make that choice freely without anyone forcing them. Mm. Basically, they have to get what's going on, the potential consequences, and the downsides of going it alone.
Mm. Got it. And in Cornell's case, the Arizona Supreme Court decided that he did meet that high bar.
They did, yeah. They pointed to the fact that he was found competent to stand trial, and even though he chose to be his own lawyer, he still had that advisory counsel there throughout the whole thing. And they said they didn't have any serious doubts about his ability to understand what was happening and participate in the trial in a meaningful way.
But there was a dissenting opinion on that point, right? From
yeah.
Justice Martone. What was his main argument?
Justice Martone raised this really interesting point, what's called hybrid representation, which is when a defendant represents themselves, but they also have this advisory counsel who can jump in for certain parts of the defense. Mm-hmm. And Justice Martone argued that the Arizona rules of criminal procedure don't actually allow for this kind of hybrid situation. He said that under the rules, a defendant either has a lawyer or they don't. And he thought that letting advisory counsel participate actively creates a situation that the rules don't allow for. And this highlights a tricky balance that courts often have to deal with. Being super strict about following procedural rules while also dealing with the messy reality of complex legal cases.
So he wasn't necessarily saying that Cornell wasn't mentally capable of representing himself, but that having advisory counsel participate in that specific way wasn't technically allowed under Arizona law.
Exactly. And it shows that even in areas of law that seem really settled, there can still be debate and different interpretations about exactly how the rules should be applied.
Okay, so we've covered the indictment, the prosecutor's conduct, and the whole self-representation issue. Now, let's get to the part of this case that probably got the most attention. The Arizona Supreme Court's decision to actually reduce Cornell's death sentence. Why did they make such a big change?
Well, that decision all came down to this very specific legal thing that's crucial in death penalty cases. Aggravating circumstances. To give someone a death sentence, the sentence, in this case, the trial court, has to find at least one aggravating factor you know, something that's laid out in the law that makes the defendant more blameworthy than just the murder itself. And in Cornell's case, the trial court had used a prior felony conviction as one of those aggravating factors.
Oh, so I'm guessing that prior conviction must have been overturned or found invalid somehow later on.
You got it. After Cornell's trial and after he was given the death sentence, the prior felony conviction was reversed. So when the Arizona Supreme Court looked at the case again, one of the main legal reasons the trial court had used to justify the death sentence was gone. It wasn't valid anymore.
Okay, so with that key aggravating factor taken away, the appellate court decided to step in and change the sentence themselves.
Yeah, instead of sending the case back to the trial court for a whole new sentencing hearing, the Arizona Supreme Court used their power to directly reduce the sentence to life in prison without parole.
And once again, Justice Martone had a different opinion on this part of the ruling too, didn't he?
He did.
Sounds like he had some strong feelings about how appellate courts should handle sentencing reviews.
Yeah, he agreed with the majority that the death sentence couldn't stand because of that reverse conviction. But he argued that the better move would have been to send the case back to the trial court. His reasoning was that the trial judge, the one who was there for the whole trial and the original sentencing, was in the best position to reevaluate everything, you know, to weigh any remaining aggravating circumstances, if there were any, against any mitigating circumstances that might be there. And he thought that letting the original sentencing court handle that reweighing process was the right way to do things. You know, it was more in line with how sentencing is supposed to work. It shows this tension in the legal system between trying to be efficient and make things final, while also making sure everything is carefully reevaluated in these super high stakes cases.
So you have the majority of the court prioritizing efficiency and getting the case wrapped up. And then you have the dissenting justice saying, no, it's the trial court's job to do the sentencing. And they need to look at all the factors again really carefully.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It really shows you how judges can have different philosophies when it comes to death penalty cases and what role appellate courts should play in reviewing those sentences.
Wow, this case is like a goldmine of insights for anyone going into the legal field. What would you say are the absolute most important takeaways that law students should really focus on from State v. Cornell?
I think there are a few really big lessons here. First of all, it really drives home how crucial prosecutorial ethics are. Even when it seems like there's overwhelming evidence that a defendant is guilty, prosecutors have to avoid saying things that could mislead the jury or doing anything that could prejudice the jury against the defendant. That go-free comment, even though it was ultimately considered harmless in this case, is a really stark reminder of that ethical line that prosecutors can't cross.
Right. Just that one comment, even though it didn't overturn the conviction, really shows how much power a prosecutor's words can have on a jury's decision making.
Absolutely.
Wow.
The second big takeaway is that courts are incredibly careful when a defendant decides to waive their right to a lawyer. They go to great lengths to be sure the decision is made knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily. It's not just a box to be checked, and then the whole discussion about hybrid representation adds another layer of complexity, showing that even when a defendant wants to represent themselves, the rules about how that can happen can be really specific and open to different legal interpretations.
Right. It's not as simple as it might seem on the surface.
Not at all. And the third key point is that in death penalty cases, the aggravating factors that are presented have to be accurate and legally sound. Because, as we saw with Cornell's case, if there's a mistake with one of those factors, it can have massive consequences on appeal.
Yeah.
Those factors need to be rock solid, both in terms of the law and the facts.
Yeah, and it really highlights how important the role of appellate courts is to scrutinize those sentencing decisions and fix any legal errors that might have happened.
Absolutely.
And then finally, the dissenting opinion, especially the parts about the standard for appellate review of sentencing, show us that even within the judicial system, there can be different views on how to handle these really serious cases. Some judges might prioritize efficiency and finality, while others focus more on sticking to procedure, like making sure aggravating and mitigating factors are reweighed at the trial level. It's fascinating to see those different perspectives play out.
Right.
So State v. Cornell, it's not just some story about a past crime. It's a window into some of the core principles and ongoing debates within our legal system. It's a really valuable case to study.
I agree. It's a great example.
So for everyone listening, especially those of you on the path to becoming legal professionals, this case is such a good illustration of how criminal procedure, legal ethics, and appellate practice, they're all tied together. It shows how even seemingly straightforward cases can have all these hidden complexities that can really change the outcome. And it's a clear reminder that no matter how strong the evidence might seem, the integrity of the process and sticking to those fundamental legal principles, that's what matters most.
I couldn't agree more. It's a good reminder that these procedural and ethical considerations, they're not just some abstract ideas. They have real-world consequences for people's lives and for how fair and just our legal system really is.
So as you keep thinking about this case, here's something to consider. Given how complex self-representation is and how easy it is for prosecutors to make mistakes, even unintentional ones, what's the best way for our legal system to make sure that we're protecting the rights of the accused while also making sure justice is served? Think about the different viewpoints we talked about today. The majority's reasoning and Justice Martone's dissent, they both offer important perspectives.
Yeah, and for anyone who wants to dive even deeper into these issues, I'd recommend checking out the Arizona Rules of Criminal Procedure and looking at other case law that deals with prosecutorial misconduct and the intricacies of the right to self-representation. There's always more to learn and explore.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into State v. Cornell. We'll be back soon with another important case to unpack.
See ya.
All right, see you then.
Bye.
Bye.